From the Sky News Centre at 5, David Cameron's been forced on the defensive over the NHS after a Conservative MP launched a stinging attack. The Tory leader says we should be proud of the health service, but his MEP Daniel Hannan says he wouldn't wish it on anyone. He was speaking in America, where there's a huge debate about Barack Obama's health reforms.
It gives people access to healthcare who perhaps wouldn't have it in a different system.
You see so many people that don't have access to healthcare, and if they had better access, it would be... I would feel better about things.
My health care right now, it's incredible, and I'm totally against socializing health care.
The first trials of the swine flu vaccine destined for UK patients has begun. 128 adults are taking part in Germany. Results are expected in September. The jobs of 1,200 staff at Airbus are more secure thanks to a cash injection from the government. The aerospace giant's getting a £340 million loan to develop its A350XWB model at plants in Bristol and Broughton in North Wales. It's less than Airbus had wanted. Tom Williams, the executive vice president of Airbus, says it's an investment and not state aid.
The fact that the aircraft has already had almost 500 orders demonstrates that this will be a very efficient aeroplane. So I think it's, first of all, a very good investment, not only in financial terms, but in terms of high technology, high quality jobs.
Meanwhile, 850 people have been made redundant after Allied Carpets collapsed last month. The administrator hadn't been able to find buyers for the firm's remaining 142 stores. About 50 of the company's outlets were sold last month, safeguarding about a third of the workforce. The mystery over the whereabouts of a huge cargo ship's been solved. Missing freighter Arctic Sea's been spotted 400 miles off Cape Verde on the west coast of Africa. The ship lost contact with authorities 2 weeks ago. And Robbie Williams has confirmed he is going to appear on the new series of The X Factor. Details about exactly what he'll be doing, however, are still being finalised. That's the latest. I'm Harriet Castle.
To BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week, food writer and one-time editor of the Soil Association's magazine Living Earth. That's Elizabeth Winkler. Our old Labour political pundit and economics expert Martin Summers is here too. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories, and then in the second half of the show we'll be getting Elizabeth's take on some recent food scares, real or imagined. But before that, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. Temperatures this weekend averaging around 17 degrees Celsius, fairly cloudy on Saturday, with some rain in the evening, sunnier and dry on Sunday. Next week, quite a bit warmer, it's 21 degrees Celsius with a high of 24 on Wednesday, fairly sunny and a dry week. Next weekend, that's the 22nd and 23rd of August, average 19 degrees Celsius and plenty of rain on Saturday, although I don't know if plenty of rain is quite the right way to put it, but anyway, there will be quite a lot of rain next Saturday and cloudy next Sunday, and that's the 22nd and the 23rd of August. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and I'm joined this week by food writer Elizabeth Winkler. Elizabeth, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, how did you come to be editor of the Soil Association magazine?
I actually was called in by a friend of mine who was... I just took the job temporarily, actually, to help someone out. As soon as I walked in, I was a freelance journalist. I had been a freelance journalist. And as soon as I walked in, I thought, oh, this is the job for me. It was my dream job. I applied for the permanent one.
So what was it that appealed to you about that particular job, editing that magazine?
Well, because it pulls together a lot of the issues that I really care about. And also, in a sense, I was being paid to campaign for the things that I believe in, which was a first in my life.
And now you're food editor at The Source magazine. What's The Source magazine?
The Source is the leading, if not the only, green magazine in the Southwest.
And whereabouts do you find it?
Well, it's free to pick up in most places. So you will find it in all sorts of outlets around the southwest, in farm shops and cafes and sports centres and health centres and places like that. And we are becoming much... You'll notice us more around Bristol and Bath. And also, good news for us, we are doing the... to celebrate our increased presence in Bristol and this area, we are doing the Organic Food Festival programme, the Soil Association Festival, which is... Shall I mention the date?
Yeah, talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, probably most people in Bristol know it because it's a big feature. It's been a big annual feature. And it's on the 12th to the 13th of September. So that's the whole weekend.
And whereabouts is it? It was at the Watershed last time I went to it.
Yeah, it's moved on since then.
Ah, right, okay. It's now
most of the harbour side, in fact. And so some of it's outdoors and some of it's indoors. And it's a great show because basically it's mainly small producers, small family businesses, small farmers coming to literally sell their wares in a marketplace.
Lovely, right. And also Martin Summers is here too, our old Labour economics expert and sometime pundit. Anyway, Martin, this week, tell us a little bit about your time at the New Economics Foundation. Who are they?
The New Economics Foundation were an offshoot of the ideas of the economist C.F. Schumacher, who wrote the book Small is Beautiful in the 1970s. I worked there in the early 1990s as their East European project worker. And they are promoters of all things green and humane.
Okay. So what were you actually doing there?
Well, as I was their East European project worker.
So what did that mean practically?
Well, the Berlin Wall had just come down. We had some money from Scott Barder Commonwealth, which is a co-op, to promote green economic thinking in the newly liberated Eastern Europe, and I was tasked with that role.
And where do you get your news every week? From the Bristol Evening Post or one of the national broadsheets or internet? Or?
I use the internet a lot. I've become a convert to the internet because most people don't realise that there is an English language press in most countries in the world. And if you really want to know what's going on in a country, you should read the press from that country. So if you want to know what's going on in Russia, you read the Russian press in English.
What about you, Liz, as a journalist? Whereabouts do you get your news?
Well, I must say that nowadays I get it mostly from the web. I love a newspaper. It's a treat now, buy the Sunday newspaper. But for a daily update, definitely the web.
What about you, Tony? Websites? I'm thinking particularly food-related ones. Are there any other people maybe haven't been to before? If you can plug one, that'd be nice.
Well, I think the Soil Association website is really good. And The Ecologist is very good. It's a green magazine, but it covers food. And The Source now has a website. It's relaunched its website. And blogs, well, I write a blog, and I also go and visit other people's blogs. And I spend quite a lot of time, interestingly enough, I find there's quite a few American blogs that I really rate very highly because they are very political. That's quite interesting. When I say political, it's extraordinary to think that food is political, but yes, it is. And when I say political, I'm talking about bloggers who are just wanting natural to eat well. And that is a political issue.
Okay, and what's your blog?
My blog is called Real Food Lover. And I literally talk about the food that I'm actually eating. I'm a bit obsessive now. I take a photograph of every meal I eat just about, but I also talk about issues.
Do you Twitter when you're saying, oh, I'm having a particularly nice meal right now? I do
because now I've got Twitter on my phone, by the way, free upgrade. It was just but it's very addictive.
Okay, anyway, let's now take a look at some of this week's stories, and we're starting off with looking at the opening of the new Primark superstore here in Bristol. Ethical protesters apparently have failed to deter the bargain hunters at the launch of the vast new Primark superstore. Before we discuss this, though, I was outside Bristol's new Primark shop yesterday to find out who the people with the banners outside were and what they were protesting about.
My name's Anna McMullen. I work for Labour Behind the Label, who are a human rights campaigning for garment workers' rights around the world. And we're here today because Primark is opening in Bristol. And Labour Behind the Label have had a campaign with Primark for the last year or so, and we kind of feel since they're opening on our home turf, it's quite important that we have a presence here. We've got an issue with Primark, primarily because they're the leading business who are pushing fast fashion.
What is fast fashion?
Well, fast fashion is the way in which people are buying clothes at a higher rate and throwing away quite quickly things that break. And there's just there's a much higher turnover more recently. The issue with this is that then they're driving all of their competitors also to be producing at that rate and at that cheapness. And the way that that's kind of playing out through supply chains is that it's resulting in exploitation and overtime and poor wages at the bottom end for workers.
Okay, so what is actually behind the label? What's really going on behind the scenes with much of the goods that are being sold here today?
There was a War and Want report published last November which found Primark workers in Bangladesh being paid 7 pence an hour. So those sort of wages are about a third of what a living wage ought to be. And a living wage would allow a worker to live in dignity and also be able to feed their children and send them to school and travel around to have transport to get to work and back. At the moment, they can't afford to do any of those things.
But you see, the thing is, this is very popular. There's loads of people turned out for the opening day here, and Primark's almost full.
Yeah, well, Primark is a very popular concept. The thing is that it is so desirable because we're sold the idea that we can have cheap clothes and expect that people can have a fair wage at the other end of the system. But it actually just isn't possible.
Okay, that was Anna McMullen from a group called Labour Behind the Label, who are based here in Bristol. So what are your thoughts on that? Maybe you first, Martin. What about the new Primark? Is it a wonderful thing you're going to get going down there and doing your shopping for your clothes?
Well, most of the clothes they have in Primark are not really the sort of thing I wear. I think we should all be thinking when we're consuming anything, whether it's food or clothes, about the production of those things that we produce, that we're consuming. And that is the way forward. People need to be confident when they're buying anything, whether it's a frozen chicken or a T-shirt, that the production has not harmed the environment or driven people to poverty or despair. I mean, the rules should make it clear that's not allowed. But of course, we don't live in that world. It's quite possible for the unscrupulous to exploit the environment and the human population.
So, Elizabeth, are you going to be one of the people down at Primark snapping up the bargains?
I have, to be perfectly honest, yes, I have been into Primark, I confess. It's very tempting to buy cheap clothes that look nice. I'm a great fan of charity shops, and I always feel, I think I feel much more jubilant when I get something nice from the charity shop. I think it's a really thorny issue. Definitely, and I think Labour Behind the Labour label, I'm grateful to them for highlighting the issues. And it was interesting what Martin said, and I think what I'd quite like to see, if this was possible, is to have transparency about, well, how do you make your clothes? And so it's fine if people are just put the facts, put the truth. Yes, so-and-so was paid such and such. And no, they can't join unions, but they're paid this. And yes, they have to work for 80-hour week. And then people can make up their own minds.
So are you talking about, say, labelling on the clothes themselves, something that's that says how many stars maybe for the kind of quality and the pay and conditions of the workers that have produced the material?
Yeah, why not? Yes. I just had this wild idea while Martin was talking that you wouldn't even need to star it. You could just give the facts and let people decide.
Okay, but it's rather difficult for people to decide in a recession, a global recession, to be paying more for their clothes. That's what we're asking them to do here, isn't it?
Yes, but I think what we need to do is look at all markets as requiring some kind of regulation. Otherwise, the most unscrupulous producers always will outcompete the less scrupulous producers. And that's why, although I'm in favour of consumers, as Elizabeth suggests, being given information and encouraged to choose rightly, as it were, I think also you have to have regulations in markets to make sure that minimum standards are upheld. So, for example, in relation to things like chicken production, which is not clothes production. If we people will always buy the cheaper chicken if it's there on the shelf. If you make it illegal to provide it at that price and in that way, then they'll have to pay a bit more. And if that means that people have to raise that, people say, well, the poor people will suffer. Well, no, not if you raise people's benefits so that they can take account of being, you know, currently benefit rate is £60-70 a week for people on JSA. If you're going to have a kind of a food policy that says that we're going to make all food properly produced and at a reasonable price, then you have to raise benefit levels to go with that. But then we need to rethink a lot of these things. You know, this sounds like pie in the sky, but it's not really, because the whole economy is now up for question.
Yeah, but we aren't in the situation financially, surely, that we can say, oh, it's time to up the benefit levels. That's the last thing the government are thinking about.
Well, I think they ought to be upping the benefit levels just for macroeconomic reasons.
Yes, it's interesting, the idea of make it illegal, up people's benefits, and I'm really sort of, my mind is racing as you're talking with this concept. I think one of the problems with chicken production is that, yes, I think this country is moving towards better poultry conditions. I think it will take a while, obviously, for industrial food production to become more humane, if that's the correct word to use for animals. But then, of course, you need it global, because what's happening is that British farmers are indeed trying to improve the lot of the chicken. But then what's happening is that we are getting cheap imports from other countries which are not regulated. And that undermines the whole thing, makes it quite hard for the British farmer.
Well, that's sort of similar to the whole situation with Primark, and it does seem to be rather difficult to find a way out of that. Anyway, on to the next story, and we're told, this is a comment from the Daily Mail, a dodgy denial, it says. The boss of MI6, who the James Bond, the Foreign Intelligence Service, Secret Intelligence Service, says that the Britain is not committing torture. It's their 100th anniversary year this year, because there's been lots of rumours about the possibility of the intelligence people in this country being in some way colluding with torture, if not actually taking part in it themselves. Martin, do you want to start on that?
Well, I think that, don't forget that these people are professional liars and that's their job. So, of course, he says that we're not involved in torture, but there's quite a...
I know Craig Murray on his blog actually said that about John Scarlett, and he's an ex-ambassador who...
Yeah, I mean, we can take this with a pinch of salt. There are several cases pending against the government where the plaintiffs claim that MI6 and MI5 officers were present while they were being tortured. There's clearly a lot of dispute about the truth of it and veracity of his statement. And as you were saying, it's the 100th anniversary of MI6. Can we have an apology from MI6 for overthrowing the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953? Because a lot of the trouble we've got now stems from then. And I think if we actually went back and looked through MI6's glorious history, we'll find that there's plenty of other similar glorious activities to their name.
Well, I'm afraid that's all buried in a vault very deep underneath Whitehall, and lots of locks and keys.
What they're trying to do now is present themselves as some kind of squeaky clean anti-terrorist outfit, when in actual fact, if you actually look at the history of MI6, it's been involved in all sorts of dirty dealings around the world for many years, which have given us a very bad reputation in developing countries, and rightly so.
Elizabeth, what do you think, we can trust the MI6 boss John Scarlett when he says that the MI6 has not been involved in any torture?
I found that quite laughable. I think there was a comedy. It was extraordinary. No, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't trust it. What we've heard from, say, for instance, Guantanamo detainees, for instance, that's just a small example. It's very clear that MI6 has been involved in such things, and I find it quite outrageous that he can make a statement like that.
But is there anything we can do about it, or anyone can do about it, because this is the intelligence service and they have a kind of wall of steel around them, and no one really is able to penetrate that? They're not accountable.
Well, they ought to be accountable, shouldn't they? I mean, if they want, for example, the Muslim community to cooperate with their anti-terrorist activities, then they have to come clean when they're caught out. I mean, how can they expect any credibility unless they do?
Well, I said they're not accountable. Well, we do have the Intelligence and Security Committee in Parliament, which is supposed to oversee all their activities, and they have been brought in the last 10 years or so into law for the first time, because they were outside the law.
Well, really, exactly. I mean, what we probably need to do is rewrite the whole real relationship between the security services and the democratically elected government, because it has been based really upon an old boys' network up to now, and that really isn't good enough, not in the 21st century.
And once again, I think it's a case of transparency. Okay, why doesn't MI6 say, yeah, we use torture, and then the people can decide?
Well, then, I mean, maybe this is what they should be doing for their 100th anniversary, eh?
Yeah, good idea.
OK, next story. We were duped, say two British women used in the US health campaign. Now, this is about two women who were filmed being told it was going to be used on the internet, and then it's since been used to attack the National Health Service as part of the Republican campaign in the United States against Obama's new health reforms. Martin, you want to start on this one?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's another related story is that a Tory MEP has gone on television in the United States saying that he wouldn't wish the National Health Service on anybody, and he's been slapped down by David Cameron. But I think the words of the Tory MEP are basically showing what the fundamental attitude of many Tory activists to the National Health Service actually is, to the embarrassment of David Cameron.
Do you think then that the Tory party is actually a bit closer to the Republican Party than they would like to have us believe?
Well, I think that Cameron will not be happy about this chap speaking out, but I think that the real issue, as we go into a massive financial and economic crisis, will be they won't be that what if we get a Tory government, for example, what they will say is we don't want to cut money on the NHS, but we've got no choice because blah blah blah. Now coming back to what we were saying earlier about benefits, cutting public expenditure in a recession is balmy, and if they try and do it, they'll realise very quickly that it doesn't work.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think this is not the time to make life harder for people. What I found really interesting in this story actually was what it revealed to me about the mindset of certain Republican thinking. This kind of hysteria about how the NHS equals Soviet Russia or some dictatorship. You mean, hello, it's wrong to, I mean, wrong to be helped if you're dying, and that this money comes from a collective purse.
It destroys your dignity.
What's that, Martin?
It destroys your dignity to be helped when you're dying. You should just die.
Why is it, do you think, that the Americans have such a problem with the idea of Britain and with the National Health Service? Over here, it's quite a popular thing. Many people have been helped by it. Probably everybody has been touched by it one way or another. So why is it such a problem in the US?
Because they've got vast vested interests who are profiting from the status quo. I mean, they spend nearly 15% of their gross national product on healthcare, which is far greater than we do, and 40 million people have no healthcare. But, of course, many people are making a lot of money out of insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, private hospitals, and they don't want to change.
Okay, next story. Now, this is early, right at the beginning of the week. We were being told by Leicestershire Police that some beggars are earning £200 a month, and headlines were appearing saying beggars are earning £73,000 a year. Elizabeth,
on £200 a month?
Sorry, £200 an evening. Sorry, £200 a night. And if you add that all together, then apparently it makes £73,000 a year. Elizabeth?
Okay, well, I get quite upset at these, what I call anti-beggar stories, because people who beg, I don't think, honestly, that it is your job of choice. And to then hit people over the head with that accusation that they are, you know, making loads of money is just, I find that quite distressing, actually.
Well, why do you think the police are saying this, then?
Well, I'd love to know what they based that statement on. Have they got a factual story?
I think they based it on maybe they've arrested somebody and found that they've got £200, and they've said that they've begged that in an evening. So they're extrapolating that to what is that? If that's in one evening, what's that over a whole year?
Can I just make the comment? This is a free market interaction. Somebody begs, somebody gives them money, they earn £73,000 a year. That's hardly an MP's expenses or a banker's bonus. And they're showing entrepreneurial skill. They're going out and selling something, i.e. their beggariness, and they're getting paid for it. What's the problem?
Well, apparently the problem is that some of these people are actually reasonably well off and have homes. They're not homeless and they're in the street. This is at least what these Leicestershire police or the newspapers are saying about the police statement, and that they don't really need to be there because they're quite well off.
Well, as I agree with Elizabeth that most people begging are begging because they have no other choices. Probably they are possibly spending the money on drugs and drink, perhaps, but then that's because they're in a sad situation in their lives. Whenever I give money to beggars, I say, make sure you do spend it on drugs or drink or I'll be disappointed.
Okay, but moving a little bit closer to home. First Great Western, that's also known as Worst Late Western by some, is off-peak Bristol to London fare. That's the £60 return fare. It's not available until later in the mornings from now on. Otherwise, you will have to pay the full fare of nearly £150 for a train trip to London. Elizabeth, well, this isn't really sustainable transport for those people. This is rather expensive. And they're going to be much tempted to take their cars, aren't they?
Of course, yeah. This is again a story that I find quite enraging. I have family in London. I have a father who's not well, and so I really need to go to London. And this is just making, quite apart from work, going to London. So this is making it so much harder for people, and is not encouraging people to travel by a more green option. Trains are this is the sustainable way to travel, as opposed to each person getting into their car. And so there is a lack of joined up thinking. The government is talking about is acknowledging the problems of climate change, and yet somehow this massive corporation is now hiking the prices, making it putting it out of reach of people to do the green thing.
It does seem that the £150 return fare to London is the sort of thing that maybe a company can afford to pay as an expense, but for an individual to fish in their pocket and pay £150 for a trip to London most people aren't going to do it.
Absolutely, and as far as I know, I believe that First Great Western profits are healthy, so why are they putting the prices up?
Well, I think it just shows that when you spoke earlier about joined-up thinking, there's no joined-up structure to put that thinking into practice. The transport system has been fragmented, so first set off to do whatever they want to do in order to maximise their shareholders' profits, but that's not necessarily in the interest of the system as a whole. When the railways were nationalised at the end of the Second World War, the idea was to have a national plan about transport, and when Labour were elected in 1997, they said that's what they were going to do, but they've caved in front of the vested interests of the road lobby and all the rest of it, and nothing has been done in all the time they've been in power, and now it seems to be too late. Although, of course, having a transport plan and then investing in that plan might be the way to turn the economy around.
So is that what you'd do if you were a Chancellor?
Yes, instead of giving the money to the banks.
Yeah, I like the idea. I think that's right. I think if we really took a serious approach to going green, we would find that we would not only save money, but we would create jobs as well. And I think this is really the sensible way to go.
So why is it, do you think, that the first have put their, are in the situation where they can just put the fares up when they want to? Because apparently it's cheaper to go, I was reading also in the same article in the Evening Post, cheaper to go to Newcastle now, apparently, than it is to go to London.
Yeah, but that's because the London to Bristol, the Bristol to London is an extremely popular route. It's where it's a cash cow. And first have been given it as a cash cow. If it was being run as part of an integrated nationalised system, you would probably have a different pricing structure.
But that's just winding the clock back, isn't it? Trying to have a nationalised railway.
I think it's reinventing the wheel. Sadly, we've got to reinvent the wheel because the Tory government smashed the wheel, and we've now got to put it back together again.
I have to say that whenever I'm on a train and things go wrong, I've never heard anyone. I mean, everyone I talk to, from the guards, from the passengers, everyone's yearning for renationalising the railways.
They did do it in New Zealand. The Labour government in New Zealand did renationalise the railway. So if you say it can't be done, I say it can be done, and it needs to be done.
Wouldn't it be great if the Conservative Party renationalised the railways?
I don't know if that's going to happen. On to the next story. And this is the 200th death in Afghanistan will raise questions over the UK strategy. We're now at the 199 soldiers have died over in Afghanistan now, as of today. And we're staring in the face the idea that we're going to have the 200th possibly soon. Martin, what do you think about this one?
Well, Bristol Stop the War Coalition are calling for people to assemble opposite the Hippodrome when the 200th soldier dies that evening and on the following Saturday to read out the names of the soldiers and also the names of some of the Afghans who've died in the conflict. It is a moment for reflection. I think we've been collecting signatures against the war in Afghanistan over the last few Saturdays in the centre of Broadmead, and we've had a very good response from people, particularly from women, especially with these young soldiers dying who are 18 years old. Harry, we were talking about Harry Patch dying last week, and yet young boys are still being sent to fight unwinnable wars in foreign countries where we can't really understand what, most ordinary people can't really understand what we're doing there.
I mean, I believe the Afghanistan war is like the Iraq war, is an oil war. It's a war to, it's a fight over oil resources, which really brings us back to the green agenda, that rather than killing people in other countries to protect this scarce resource, we should be looking at sustainable ways of living.
Okay, the final story we're looking at this week is the US and British relatives are split, apparently, we're told in The Guardian today, over the release of the Lockerbie bomber, or at least the chap who was imprisoned and convicted of the bombing. Martin, what do you know about this? Why are the American relatives and victims' families and the British so split on this issue?
I think because the British have a better media and are more aware of the questions that are surrounding Libya's guilt or lack of guilt in this particular case. The Scottish police, who were originally investigating the case for over a year, were suggesting that in actual fact the blowing up of the Lockerbie airliner was a response to the shooting down of the Iranian Airbus over the Gulf by the Americans, and it was probably a contract put out by Iran and carried out by Syria. Now, of course, Syria and Iran then supported the allied so-called coalition against Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait. So it was very embarrassing for Syria, who were lining up in the desert alongside our boys, to be accused of blowing up our airliners. So it was switched to Libya, and Libya was then put in the frame. Most serious analysts have always thought that the Libyans were innocent of this. The Americans are obviously tearing their hair out because they don't understand the real politic of it. Jim Swire, who speaks on behalf of the British families, understands what's underlying all of this. And of course, what the Americans have got to understand is if the wrong person's in prison, the people who really did it are still walking free. And the same goes, this was what we had in this country with the Guildford 4 and the Birmingham 6. The people who actually did it got away with it because you got the wrong people. And that's what people have got to understand. There's no machismo glory in locking the wrong people up. It means that the people who really did it get off.
I think there's some serious doubts about whether this person who is imprisoned was responsible for it, and there is the evidence that's now emerging that it sounds like he clearly had an alibi. He wasn't where he was supposed to be. He was wrongly accused. So yes, absolutely, I agree with Martin that if he was wrongly accused, then who did it?
Can I just add another comment on this. When you are told by the government that X, Y or Z happened after a terrorist attack like the Lockerbie bombing, you don't necessarily have to take that at face value. What seems to have happened here is that the decision to go after Libya was an entirely political decision related to geopolitical considerations and nothing at all to do with who was actually guilty. And that could be true of any terrorist attack. For example, the London bombings, which we've covered on previous programmes.
Well, I'll just wind up there by saying that there's another reason I think maybe that the US and British relatives are split, and that is because there's a very good documentary made by Alan Frankovich called The Maltese Double Cross, and that was only shown in Britain. It hasn't still never been shown on television in the United States, and that was an analysis of the whole episode. I think it's a 2.5 hours long, if my memory serves me correct, but it's a really in-depth analysis, and you can find it on Google Video or one of these other video things on the internet if you want to, called The Maltese Double Cross. Anyway, we'll be going on to speak to Elizabeth Winkler a bit more in a minute about food, mostly, and allotments. But before that, there's a song sung by Maggie Holland, a June Tabor song called A Place Called England.
I rode out on a bright May morning, a hero and a song, looking for a place called England, trying to find where I belong. Couldn't find the old flood meadow or the house that I once knew, no trace of that little river or the garden where I grew. I saw town and I saw country, motorway and sink estate. Rich man in his rolling acres, poor man still outside the gate. Retail park and Burger Kingdom, prairie field.
train pulled from the station through the wastelands of despair. From the corner of my eye, a brightness filled the filthy air. Someone sown a patch of sunflowers, though the soil is sooty black. Marigolds and a few tomatoes right beside the railway track. Behind the terraced houses, in between the concrete towers, compost heaps and scarlet runners, secret gardens full of flowers. Lita grows her scented roses right beneath the big jet's path. Bid a fortune for her garden, Eileen turns away and laughs. Rise up, George, and wake up, Arthur. Time to rouse out from your sleep. Deck the horse with sea-green ribbons. Drag the old sword from the deep. Hold the line for Dave and Daniel as they tunnel through the clay, while the oak in all its glory sucks up sun for one more day. Come all you at home with freedom, whatever the land that gave you birth. There's room for you, both root and branch, as long as you love the English earth. Room for vole and room for orchid, room for all to grow and thrive. Just less room for the fat landowner on his arse in his four-wheel drive. It is not blood, it's limestone gorge and granite fell, it's weald and clay and seven mud, it's blackbird singing from the may tree, lark ascending through the scales, robin watching from your spade, and English earth beneath your nails. Here's two cheers for a place called England, sore abused but not yet dead. A Mr. Harding sort of England hanging in there by a thread. Here's two cheers for the crazy diggers, now their hour shall come around. We shall plant the seed they saved us, commonwealth and common ground. The crazy diggers, now their hour is come around. We shall plant the seed they saved as commonwealth and common ground.
That's Maggie Holland and Jude Tabor's song A Place Called England. Anyway, I'm joined in the studio now by Marina Morris. Today, Marina, you've been investigating the attitudes of leaders of state to the food and its contribution to a healthy lifestyle.
Yes, we are living longer and now we have to prepare to stay healthy and active in old age. What example do the heads of state set for the world? Queen Elizabeth II, 83, has turned a corner of Buckingham Palace backyard into an allotment. For the first time since the war, fruit and vegetables are to be found in an allotment-sized plot in the garden of Buckingham Palace. The first harvest, a selection of Cambridge favourite strawberries, was served to the Queen and Prince Philip on his 88th birthday this June. Michelle Obama, the United States First Lady, is to create an organic garden at the White House, the first since Eleanor Roosevelt's Victory Garden, planted during World War II. Michelle Obama's decision to plant a vegetable garden is an important political and symbolic statement about the future, but it also echoes the beliefs of the founding fathers. They thought not only that gardening was the healthiest of all occupation, but that the American people should be encouraged to grow vegetables to improve their diet. Prince Charles, a long-term supporter of organic food, has criticized as a poor piece of work the Food Standards Agency, a recent study into the benefits of organic food, which concluded that expensive organic food is no better for you than produced from intensive farms.
Thanks, Marina. And we'll be talking about that Food Standards Agency report in a moment. But first, I'm going to ask you, Elizabeth, is this the idea of having allotments at Buckingham Palace and the White House, is this really going to change anything? Or is it tokenism or is it a good thing?
I think it's a great idea. It's brought to our attention that that's possible to do, that you can have a garden and you can use your garden to produce food. So I think it's great. And I'll tell you something else about the Michelle Obama story. What I found quite interesting is that she did actually receive quite a lot of criticism from the manufacturers of pesticides, who complained that she was being it was un-American to show people how to grow food, because I'm not quite sure what the reason was, but as if it was undermining the industry.
Well, they sound like chances to me. I'm not sure if anyone's going to really believe that.
The point is, I think most people relate to the idea of growing food. It's what people have always done. And
yeah. Anyway, now on with Marina's report, because Marina has been loitering on the streets of Bristol again this week, and she's been finding out what you think about the food you eat, from organic right through to fast food.
What do you think about organic, genetically modified, and fast food?
But no, I'm completely against it. There's something like a good, honest, quality grown, ordinary, like carrot, cucumber, things like that. There's nothing that beats that. So for me, genetically modified food, no way, no. Fast food as well. Yeah, don't get me wrong, I eat it if I'm in a bit of a hurry, but no, I'd sooner have sort of like healthy, sort of like salad sandwich any day of the week than fast food, so yeah.
Organic food is good. It's a bit overpriced, but it's good. I have a son who's very overweight because he likes fast food. I am against having chains like McDonald's everywhere. It's just not good for you.
Rubbish. Expensive. Yeah, it's rubbish. I just do. And it's no nutritional value. It's what ordinary food is, and it's cheaper.
I try to buy it as often as I can. Definitely. I think it's really worthwhile. Because not just for your own health, but for the environment. I can understand why a lot of people would go for fast food, but I think that it's probably, well, on the whole, a lot less healthy for you, so I tend to stay away from it. And the same with GM foods. On the whole, I try to, just because you don't know the outcome of the GM experiments with the environment. I hear that it can be harmful for wildlife.
I think it's good, but super priced. Not really, but I think my mum gets it.
It's very overpriced. It's expensive, so only people with a lot of money tend to use it, really.
I'm a personal trainer, so that's what I do. Great. I'm into sports, yeah. It's more difficult for me in this country. I've just been here a short time, because where I come from, the fruit is in abundance. You can get a lot of fruit and a lot of vegetables. Here, because of what I do, it's more difficult for me to control what I'm eating, but I'm trying my best. Basically, the amount of fat and the amount of protein and the amount of carbohydrate and how it's balanced.
Well, I don't eat fatty foods. You just look at something and you know when it's healthy and when it's not, by what it contains, fatty food.
Protein content, because I'm vegetarian. That's usually what I always look for, but yeah, that is the only thing that I ever really look for, apart from whether it's GM or not.
And just eat what's quick and easy to get at the time.
Which information sources do you trust and use? A lot through the internet and magazines that I know. Again, not in this country so much because I've only been here 2 weeks, but we have some good magazines in Israel that you can go into and you can find a lot of information about nutrition.
Healthy lifestyle. I don't know, because it's all conflicting information. You get something what's good for you and then something what's not good for you. And if I think you haven't done exercise before, then it can be bad for you. It can cause heart problems and all that as you get older.
Which information source do you trust? I think the Soil Association are probably the best ones to go for, because they do a lot of research in it. They seem to know what they're talking about. So I think, you know, the internet is a great source, definitely. You know, you can get like a good fish guide on the internet, you know, can tell you which fish to go for. It's going to be sustainably harvested. And so I think, yeah, as long as you check out the sources on the internet you're using.
Probably magazines more than anything else, because people, like, when a magazine's printed, people can't change it, whereas on the internet people can change things. So.
Who is the best role model for you of a healthy lifestyle?
Madonna.
Oh,
she's aging with grace. She's going through the same sort of system that I went through, because I started again. I can see the way she's working out and the way she's doing a lot, because she's maintaining also a balance between her spiritual life and her nutritional and exercise and everything else that she does during the day to maintain a very busy life, which is what we all want to do.
My best example for me for a healthy lifestyle, I think it's my peers in work, to be honest with you, my friends and peers in work, because they all try and eat a healthy lifestyle. They've given me the courage and the get up and go needed to actually have the healthy lifestyle. So I think it falls down to friends more than celebrities.
I don't have anybody. I think you've got to do it for yourself and not look at someone else and not celebrities.
My auntie, probably, because she eats like healthily and then like walks a lot, and like if she doesn't need to take her car, she won't take it.
So the main problem seems to be that healthy food costs quite a bit more. Do you think that's simply the case, Elizabeth, that if you're going to eat healthily, it's going to just simply cost you more? You're going to have to accept that.
I actually disagree. I think it's true. I think it's in what you need to do to eat healthily. I think actually what it really comes down to is you need to be able to cook from scratch. Sorry, guys. So I think this is a really basic fundamental truth. So that if people could cook more from at home using, if you used organic ingredients and cook from home, you would find that you could eat organic on a budget. So what we're coming down to is education, and people have lost the skills of cooking.
So whereabouts do you get your organic food from?
Okay, well, I think Bristol is incredibly well served for fresh produce. And so, for instance, we have Rinkton Greens box scheme, and we have Radford Mill, who sells in Radford Mill shop in Montpellier, and also in a few other organic shops around.
But people can't necessarily make it to Montpellier to
no,
one of these places.
No, absolutely.
Can they?
So, therefore, I mean, the studies show, the research shows, if you want to eat organic on a budget, don't go to a supermarket, but get a veg box. Now, getting a veg box means, to my mind, it's convenient because it arrives at your house. But it does mean a slight change of mindset, because instead of going to the supermarket with your list, you look at a recipe, you go, right, I want this, and then you choose whether it's in season or not. A veg box works differently. You can choose, you can say, I just don't eat whatever it is, you know, I hate celery or whatever. That's fine. You can order the veg box with pretty much the food that you would like to eat, but you do get a certain amount of, it's if it's seasonal, which is what you really want, you will get, say, lots of potatoes, lots of beetroot, and you'll scratch your head when you get a kohlrabi. You'll say, goodness, what do I do with this? So it does take a little more thought, but on the other hand, it's kind of exciting. I've heard people say, this is such a fun way of cooking, because I don't actually know what I'm going to cook until that veg box arrives. And then I go from, this is the way people used to shop. You go to the market and you look and you see what is nice. And that's the way, that's
what,
a similar principle.
And what is
there
a lot of this week? What's in season? That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So what's the bottom line, though? This is a weekly vegetable box of vegetables delivery.
Yeah,
how much does
right.
it cost?
Well... You could...
And how many vegetables
It varies in size, but I would say roughly around £8-10 for a box. That should keep you in vegetables, but if you've got a sort of larger family, you might want to supplement it or get a bigger box. If you look on the Soil Association website, there should be comparisons about the different costs. But I would say... that supermarkets are, they don't, you know, quite apart from the price, you don't really get the freshness. I think I feel really sorry when people hear about organic, they get very excited, they want to eat organic, they walk into a supermarket and what they're seeing is food that has probably travelled quite a long distance. And I think that's a shame, because when you buy produce that is harvested that morning, it's fantastic. We all, So I think veg boxes are the way to go. And the local veg boxes, we are, as I said, well served in Bristol. There's about three or four, five schemes, including Lee Court Farm and Better Food, and probably a few, you know, many, quite a few others. And these have been harvested the night before, that day. How can you beat that?
Well, it sounds a bit difficult. Anyway, how is the food that we buy safeguarded and regulated? Because we've had this recent report from the Food Standards Agency actually saying that there is no nutritional benefit in organic food, which I do actually find a bit difficult to believe, because it does, you know, a lot of the actual surveys of this food show that it does have a better mineral content and that kind of thing. So what's happening here? Why are the Food Standards Agency saying this?
Yes, before I talk about the Food Standards Agency, I just want to mention that actually organic, apart from baby food, organic is the only most regulated food system in this country, if not the only, certainly the most regulated food system. So going back to your question about the Food Standards Agency. Food Standards Agency was set up in 2000, by Lord Rooker, who is actually the new chair of the Food Standards Agency. And I think it was set up in response to the BSE crisis. Clearly, there was a lot of consumer concern about what food was safe and what food isn't safe. So it was set up as an independent watchdog that would advise consumers. How independent it is, I'm not sure, because it's a bit of a case of jobs for the boys. You are obviously, the people who are elected to be chair and in charge tend to be what people call a safe pair of hands. It was quite interesting. Apparently there was someone was strongly advised to go for chair, and I think he was a halal meat manufacturer, and he didn't make it, and he complained about that aspect.
So why is it that the FSA is telling us that organic food is not better for us? Because this is really, as one of the people on the Vox Pop said, we're getting all sorts of conflicting information.
Yes, we are, with a lot of conflicting information. It's funny, because on the Food Standards Agency website, it actually says if you want to avoid pesticides, one way is to eat organic food. However, interestingly enough, the study that came out, was it last week or the week before? This was a study done on behalf of the Food Standards Agency, which looked at the last 50 years of research comparing organic and non-organic. But I can't get my head around it. They excluded an awful lot. Their criteria was very... they excluded an awful lot of studies, and their cutoff point made it impossible to include... the results of a European-wide research which has shown unequivocally that there are more nutrients in organic food, for instance, organic milk.
One of the reasons that I try and avoid non-organic food is simply the pesticides, because what the FSA are implying here really is that the pesticides are perfectly safe and we needn't worry about them. We shouldn't even be thinking about them. Whereas often they're sprayed on green vegetables and things as they're sitting in the supermarket to preserve their shelf life.
Absolutely.
And you know, what have you learnt through your work at the Soil Association about pesticides? And you know, should we be a little bit worried about them, or should we just ignore them?
Well, before I went to the Soil Association, I was, by preference, I ate organic food, and that was just my common sense telling me that. And then when I went to the Soil Association, everything I learnt just reinforced my already instinctual belief. And I think that I just think that it makes sense to people. Would you rather have this, as you say, that's been sprayed by chemicals, by 30 different chemicals, just so that it lasts longer and looks nicer, but doesn't actually taste better, and it's not actually doing you any good? Do you really want to have this apple this apple that's been sprayed compared to this apple, which has not been sprayed by chemicals? I think most people make a common sense decision here.
But what the FSA are implying, as I said before, though, is that this is perfectly safe. They've done all their tests or whatever.
The research didn't actually look at any studies to do with pesticides. That was one of the things they excluded, which I found kind of extraordinary, since that's one of the main reasons why people choose organic food. However, that was excluded from the study. It was a study divided into two, looking at health benefits and nutrients. The researchers themselves said there's not enough evidence, and I would agree with that. There's not enough evidence. We need more studies. And I think the FSA kind of spun it a bit, to be honest, and ended up saying organic is no better for you. But however, just in the study, in the appendix, it does actually say, yes, there are more, for instance, 53% more beta-carotene. That's what makes something look very orange in a carrot, and that's what gives you more vitamin A. So there are more nutrients in organic food.
Okay, the other thing was this whole thing of conflicting information, I think, is really quite worrying, because we're getting lots of mixed messages. Another mixed message this week was in the Daily Express. The front page lead in the Daily Express on Tuesday was the danger of just two fizzy drinks. We're being told that fizzy drinks, like Coke, could be bad for the liver due to the sugar that they contain. Being advised to avoid avoid drinking fizzy drinks. Now, to me, that immediately flags up as a problem, because the implication there is take the diet drinks. If you're going to drink anything, don't drink the sugary drinks, have the diet version. And, I mean, I sat and watched a few weeks ago a film on the internet called Sweet Misery, which is all about artificial sweeteners. Now, what are your thoughts about that? The things like these food additives, like these sweeteners, should be being told not to have the normal Coke, but have the diet Coke instead?
Well, I think that the research said, please, parents, put a bottle of water in your child's lunchbox. Don't put the sugary drinks in. But when I think the soft drinks manufacturer spokeswoman said was trying to sell the drinks without, which are low sugar but high in additives and high in sugar substitutes. I think that we've got into this mad situation where we don't drink water, where kids don't drink water, and I don't understand it. And I think that's where we need to. Water is better for you.
Okay, final story is this: the supermarkets. This is a story from last year, that the record £116 million in fines was handed down yesterday to Sainsbury's for price fixing. Now, you were talking about the supermarkets earlier on. Do you think there's any chance that they may rehabilitate themselves, or do you just avoid supermarkets? We can't really, though, live without them, can we?
I'm sure we can live without supermarkets. The problem with supermarkets is the method of distribution, the fact that it's so centralised, it's done on this massive scale, and also it's very much, you wait till supermarkets don't actually stock a lot of food. The food is stored in either centralised places or those big trucks that go up and down the motorway. So you could rethink the whole system. From a sustainable point of view, from a health point of view, from a food security point of view, the more food is produced locally, the better. And I think we do need to rethink and get away from that centralised distribution idea.
Can I just pick up on that point? What people have got to realise is that our food production is not carried out under a free market regime. Since the 1940s, within Britain, we've had a protected policy. The Common Agricultural Policy protects European production. The United States subsidises its production. So in actual fact, when your vox poppers there are saying that organic food is more expensive and this other food is cheaper, this is all rigged. This is all rigged. Now, if we're going to rig the market, I believe in rigging markets. I don't believe in the free market. But if we are going to rig the market, we might as well rig it to get the outcomes we want, with local production, high quality, and so on and so forth. And that is the way forward. Not a complete free market in food, because that would be a disaster. But at the same time, if we're going to rig it, let's rig it to do the right things.
Okay. Can we wind up, Elizabeth, just by you giving us your blog website and a recommendation for places to look for your stuff on the internet?
Yeah, okay, so my blog is realfoodlover.wordpress.com. Just Google Real Food Lover, Hopefully you'll get there, and places to look around. If you make a decision to say, okay, I'm trying not to shop in a supermarket for a week, and start looking at other shops, just see what you find.
Lovely, thanks very much. It's nearly 6 o'clock, that's all we have time for this week. Join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the less well-reported stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you have stories you want discussed, questions about this evening's programme or would like to suggest a topic for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to our food writer guest, Elizabeth Winkler, and resident pundit, Old Labour economist, Martin Summers.